Welcome back to The Shepherd's Pie, a slice of faith for our messy lives. I'm Tony Kolenk, a professor at Ave Maria School of Law and the father of 5 grown children, also the author of inspirational fiction for teens and adults.
Just really excited. My book Incarnate has been out now from Chrism Press. It is an exciting supernatural thriller that has a lot of good Catholic themes and asks the question, what would happen if someone were to clone Jesus?
But today I'll be speaking with Bill Castle about deeper reflections on the life of Christ as set out in Bill's fascinating book, My Brother's Keeper. My guest today is Bill Castle, radio host, journalist, songwriter, and Christian entertainer. He's led a storied life, creating several programs for Ave Maria Radio, holding creative positions with such organizations as Dow Jones, McGraw-Hill, and Guitar Player magazine. He was also director of public affairs for Hillsdale College and director of communications for the Ave Maria Foundation. In addition to all of that, he's an author with several fiction titles to his name, including the one we'll be talking about today, My Brother's Keeper. And he's married with 2 grown children, and he lives with his wife, Kathleen, in Michigan. And Bill, you've interviewed me a few times on your radio show, and I've been very appreciative of that. So I'm so glad to have you on my show today. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for taking interest in this new book. I appreciate it.
So there is so much going on in your life that you've done, and maybe just kind of lay out for us, what has been the journey of your life that has brought you to kind of being an author of this sort now?
In a word, I would describe it as meandering. My career has been all over the place. It's one of those careers that might be described as checkered. I've done all kinds of work, advertising, public relations, institutional development. I worked for Hillsdale College, as you mentioned. That was a great opportunity. And with Tom Monahan's Ave Maria Foundation. Actually, it was through the Ave Maria connection that I got into religious broadcasting. I started doing work with Ave Maria Radio, some program development work and fundraising work and all of that. So it's been an interesting journey, but it brought me into the church. I'm a convert. I've taken an interest in church history, and that's kind of what sparked the idea of the book and delved into that. But it's been fun. It's been an interesting life.
Now, you've written several books, actually, and this one, My Brother's Keeper, I know you've been working on for quite some time and have had several iterations of it. It's really remarkable because you are looking at the life of Christ through the eyes of his foster brother, James.
Yeah, I was in the process of conversion, and my sister-in-law, Christine, gave me a book. It was a history of the church by Paul Johnson, the British historian, and that really piqued my interest. He went into all kinds of detail about the early church, the early Christian movement, and I began to get from that a sense that there was more to the story, that you can read the Bible and you can get kind of the broad strokes of what Jesus did and the apostles did and the early church fathers did, but you didn't get a lot of background and detail. You didn't know much about the political or social situation at the time. And so I began to think there's something here worth looking into. And I started researching it over a period of years, really. I didn't initially have the idea that I would write a book about it. I was just curious about what was actually behind the Bible stories and just kind of became caught up in it and fascinated with it. I found out about James, who this interesting religious scholar known as James the Just. And there were some researchers who claimed that he was the key figure and somehow a blood relative or somehow family member of Jesus. Couldn't have been a blood relative, but a family member. And I found that this stuff was actually documented. There were a lot of early writings of the church, the writings that didn't make it into the Bible. But they gave a lot of detail, about Jesus' family. And I thought, hey, there's something here. And so the idea of a book began to take hold in my mind, and I sort of played with it casually for a few years. And then I finally got serious, and I sat down, and I thought, well, okay, I'll write something up and see what I get out of this. And it really opened some interesting doors. It's a different way of thinking about Jesus, about his family, we have this Christmas card portrait of the Holy Family, the young carpenter and his wife. That's kind of the image that's taken hold in our culture. But these early documents make it clear that there were all kinds of connections. And so when you look into the story, it really becomes kind of a rich, textured background. My book is based on the ancient tradition that Joseph was an older widowed man with children at the time he took this young girl, Mary, as his wife. And so who were these children? You know, how was this family affected by Mary entering the household? And suddenly she has this child who begins to exhibit all kinds of interesting talents and powers that nobody would have expected. What would be the reactions that the relatives or the neighbors or the people around the town of Nazareth would have had? Just opened up all kinds of dramatic possibilities.
I've read a little bit of these. They aren't really gospels because they didn't make it into the canon, but there were all these other writings, like you mentioned. I think one of them is maybe the Gospel of Thomas that might have a story of James and Jesus going out in the woods as boys. And I think James gets bitten by a snake and Jesus heals him and this kind of thing. And you mentioned him being a blood relative or not. This has been a point of contention between Christians, especially between the Catholics and Protestants, about did Jesus have actual blood brothers or not? And obviously the Catholic tradition is Mary remained a virgin, and so Jesus would have been her only son. But there were some scholars out there saying, oh no, you know, he had brothers. And James turns out to be one of those people who are mentioned sometimes in passing as the brother of Jesus. What did you find in your historical research that might shed light on this whole kind of controversy over whether Jesus had brothers or not?
The so-called brothers and sisters of Jesus are often dismissed as cousins or distant, you know, some secondary relative. But I took these writings at face value. I certainly don't accept them as Gospels, as you say, in themselves. They didn't make it into the Bible, and there, in many cases, there were good reasons that they didn't make them. There's a lot of silliness in some of them. There's one classic story of Jesus as a little boy who's playing in a mud puddle, and he grabs a handful of mud and he fashions it into the shape of a bird, and then he breathes on it and the bird comes to life and flies away. Well, I think that the church fathers were wise not to include that. Nevertheless, these writings represent what some people in various early Christian groups believed. And so they shouldn't be ignored. We have now, at this point in the history of Christianity, we have this sort of stripped down Cliff's Notes version of Christianity. It's very spare, lacks a great deal of important detail, and we've just set all this stuff aside. But the people at the time, somebody took it seriously, and I don't think we should just dismiss it.
The other thing I think about when thinking about the life of Christ, as you know, you interviewed me recently about my book Incarnate, which is sort of a supernatural thriller looking at the possibility of a clone of Jesus in modern times. So I did a lot of looking at the same period of time, and that's where I came across the story of James and Jesus going out into the woods and this kind of thing. But what about the idea that they say Jesus' first miracle was at the wedding of Cana, turning the water into wine at the wedding, and it's one of our mysteries in the rosary and this kind of thing. How did you sort of deal with that issue if you also have sort of a young Jesus growing up with all these kind of powers that you see in these other writings?
Obviously, there's a good deal of imagination at work here. My book includes, it touches on the wedding of Cana, that shows up in it. But I have assumed that since he had a whole life prior to that, something must have happened. There must have been indications throughout his childhood, throughout the early years. And so my imagination kind of takes hold. So I assume that there was a lot more going on there than we hear about. For one thing, I think we give very scant attention to certain key factors, key bits of information that are given in the Bible about Joseph and Mary and their family connections. I mean, we think about, again, the poor carpenter and his wife, but were they really poor? The Greek word tekton, which is used in the Greek Gospels, refers to more than just a carpenter. It refers to a builder. The Holy Family lived in Nazareth. Nazareth was very close to a large city called Sepphoris. This was a major trading center It was also a major administrative center by the Romans. There would have been troops transiting through there. There would have been supplies acquired. There was a considerable Greek community. It was a wealthy town. There are all kinds of possibilities, which I explore in the book. So I present this not as a hardscrabble, poor, struggling carpenter and his wife, but as a family business. You know, he had these sons from his prior marriage, if you accept my premise. Did they participate in the business? Did they build houses? Did they acquire any sort of reputation throughout the area? Did they have clients among the Greeks and Romans? So the picture you get of Joseph is of a man who was not necessarily what you would call rich, but who has a family business, and he's respected in his community. He's regular in his attendance at synagogue. And because of all of that, he's asked to take this young girl into his household when her father is dying, and that's how he and Mary get together. They are married, but their marriage, according to the Catholic view, is of a different variety. As an older man, he doesn't make any demands upon her physical person, so she's able to retain her virginity. And I try to find logical ways of expressing all of these premises so that they're believable and some dramatic resonance.
Yeah, no doubt. But what you're doing doesn't seem all that different than the very popular show, The Chosen, where they look at the disciples of Christ and they kind of make up backstories and personalities. And I don't know that anybody should object that, you know, using your imagination and some history and staying true to the Catholic traditions, that you would make an entertaining, you know, backstory for this growing up of Jesus. So let's dive right into your premise then. So you write it through the eyes of James, and you name the book My Brother's Keeper. So tell us a little bit more about kind of what you're actually doing here with the book itself.
Yeah, well, the book has three parts. Part one is essentially the background story, how Joseph gets together with Mary, lays out all of the household. It shows James as a young boy. He wishes to become a rabbi. He's a scholarly kid. He spends a lot of time at the local synagogue and school. Well, that part carries all the way up through Mary coming into the house. Household, the virgin, the Annunciation, she finding out that she's pregnant with the child of the Holy Spirit, how his family react to this idea. Joseph doesn't believe it at first, but then he's visited by the angel and he comes to accept it, but then he has to convince his family and they're not willing to accept it. So it's all of this household turmoil related to the story. It goes up to basically Christmas. Joseph and Mary go to Bethlehem because of all of this tension within the household. And then they disappear. And we know, of course, that they go off to Egypt after Herod sends his soldiers out to find this holy child and all that stuff. So that's part one. Part two is after they come back from Egypt several years later, the family business has been struggling in Joseph's absence. James, who had hoped to be able to go into his rabbinical studies in Jerusalem, has been forced to help his eldest brother Joseph in the business, and his dreams are kind of dashed. But through circumstances within the story, he finally then is able to go to Jerusalem, and it follows his adventures in Jerusalem, becoming involved in local politics there with a reform movement in the Sanhedrin and all kinds of intricate political ins and outs. He becomes involved with Joseph of Arimathea and several other figures from the Bible, and I sort of weave the lives of these characters together, and I develop some subplots in all of that. Part three then actually focuses on the years of Jesus's active ministry. James is established as a distinguished rabbi known as James the Just. His father there's a flashback scene early in part three where it shows Joseph on his deathbed and he's asking James to look out for his little brother and all of that. So James then becomes aware that Jesus is roaming about and getting disciples. The whole John the Baptist incident is dealt with in that part of the book. Suddenly, trouble is brewing, but there is a new Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, And because of the level to which James has risen in his own career and visibility as an esteemed rabbi, Pilate wants to get to know him. James speaks Greek, so he's able to interact with Pilate very readily. Pilate enjoys his company and turns to him for advice on matters of Jewish law and religious practice. And so James sees the potential here to cultivate a good relationship with Pilate, which might come in handy at some point if his little brother does get into trouble. So there's the whole sense of a relationship between Pilate and James. Eventually, of course, all hell breaks loose and Jesus has caused tremendous controversy. And the climax of part three, as well as the climax of the book, is the famous trial before Pilate, where James argues with Caiaphas, the high priest, who has brought these charges against Jesus, heresy and sedition and trying to overthrow the empire and all of that. And James then becomes actively involved as his brother's keeper, or at least trying to be, and he tries to counter these charges. And of course, we all know how that turned out. Pilate eventually is under enormous pressure. Finally, he yields to the mob, and Jesus is crucified. And then at the end of the book, it picks up on what is actually mentioned in the Bible, that Jesus appears to James, and Jesus then commissions his brother to be the leader of the Jerusalem Mother Church. And of course, we know that in the Acts of the Apostles, it's mentioned that James plays an active part in the Jerusalem Council and all of that stuff. So it follows the arc of the whole Bible story, but it elaborates on it considerably.
No, it's fascinating. And I know you do an excellent job with this. So as you were kind of writing this, I know as a fellow author that you really do get involved in looking at things through the eyes of your protagonist and this kind of thing. And here you've got James looking at his own brother and seeing the life of Christ. And I love these kinds of reflections on the life of Christ because they really are asking, you know, what would it really be like to be around Jesus? What would he have been like? What were some of the reflections that you benefited from as you were reflecting Jesus's life through his brother's eyes?
I guess an author sort of falls in love with his characters. You spend so much time thinking about these people and trying to put yourself in their place that you really gain an enormous amount of sympathy for them. And I really, you know, felt that way about James. I really loved that character. He seemed, you know, I could appreciate a guy who was struggling first to understand what the heck was going on. What is it with this brother of mine? How can he possibly have these abilities? Is he truly the Messiah? You know, what is this whole thing all about? And that struggle is maintained through the book. Mary, my treatment of her, I tried to show that she's a very intelligent person, a sensitive person, a caring person, but she's got her own problems too. I mean, what the heck? What do you do when you're charged with raising the Son of the Living God? How do you treat this kid? Joseph, what the heck is going on here? I've got this young wife. I made this pledge to her father that I'd protect her and take care of her. And now this crazy situation has burst upon me. The rest of my kids think I'm nuts for having gotten into this whole deal. They don't know what to make of it. So there's all kinds of dramatic possibilities there when you think about how the people would have reacted. The one thing that I guess in a sort of political sense, if you will, I hope that people get from this story that there were very specific circumstances surrounding Jesus's situation. There were reasons why this happened. You know, you can look at the Bible story and you can say, here you have this guy going around touching people's lives for the better, healing the sick, raising the dead, for crying out loud. You know, what's not to like about this guy? Why would anybody want to hurt this guy? And especially, why would anybody want to do something so horrible to him as to crucify him and nail him to a cross and torture him to death? Given the information that we have through our various traditions and what Scripture tells us, it's a difficult thing to swallow. And I think that in itself is a stumbling block to the faith of many people. It doesn't make sense to them. So what I'm trying to do with this book is really show the reality of the situation. What were the politics of the time? How did Pilate interact with the local Jewish authorities? What pressures was he getting from Rome? This the situation that he was in. He had to balance all of these balls. And I think Pilate is perhaps one of the least understood and least appreciated figures in the Christian story. He was under enormous pressure. He did a lot of really good stuff. He built an aqueduct to bring water to Jerusalem because it was a chronic problem. There was never enough water in this city that was situated in this semi-arid region. They had to collect water, collect rainfall off of roofs and hold it in barrels and things like that to get them through the dry season. So he built an aqueduct to serve the city. He did a number of really positive things for which he received no appreciation from the local populace or very short-term appreciation. Then they forgot about the good things that he had done. And he was always running up against the religious sensibilities of the Jewish community. He didn't understand it. He tried to, you know, represent the Roman government in the best way he could, but he was really at a handicap. So in my story, he comes to depend on James for guidance in these matters. But it's important to get a sense of what was going on, to really understand what was going on. I think, for instance, that Jesus in his ministry actually represented a very tangible threat to the temple because people were coming to him to have their sins forgiven. Now, the Bible shows the Jewish leaders treating this as sort of blasphemous and heretical, but there was a practical side of it. And that was that Jerusalem was a company town, and the company was the temple. People came from all over to attend the temple, to have their sins forgiven by making sacrifice. And there was a lot of money. This was a cash cow. And if you could go to this itinerant preacher from Galilee and have your sins forgiven, you don't have to go to the temple, and you don't have to make sacrifice, and you don't have to buy sacrificial animals, and you don't have to make korban gifts to the priestly leadership. I mean, that was a huge economic threat. And that was one of the sources of pressure that were applied to Pilate. And I think that's largely overlooked. So there's more to the story. That's, as Paul Harvey used to say, this is the rest of the story. That's what I'm hoping people will get from the book.
It's fascinating. And I know you really do take a lot of time in the story developing these historical background details. And I will say, you know, a dear saintly woman, my second mom, really, Ruth Brown, who passed away last year at the age of 98, by the way, read your book. And she was, you know, very enamored by just the amount of reflection that somebody could get on the life of Christ and all that was going on, you know, in Jerusalem and in the Holy Land during that time. Sort of reminds me of St. Ignatius Loyola, putting yourself in the story, and you've really done that here. So to me, that's the highest praise you could ever get, as if Ruth Brown gave us that praise. But okay, so if folks really want to get a hold of this book and learn more about you and all the cool things that you've done, where would you like them to go?
This has been picked up by a company called Red Penguin Books. They're based on Long Island in New York. And it appears under their Emperor Books imprint. So your best bet would be to go to their website, which is called shopbooksdirect.com. Shopbooksdirect.com. And there's a little pull-down menu that says fiction, and just go down to the historical fiction section, and my book will be there. You can also visit my website, which is billcassel.com. That's B-I-L-L-K-A-S-S-E-L, all one word, billcassel.com. The new posting that's up there right now has a link to the Books Direct website. So that's your best bet. Barnes & Noble has it. It's getting into distribution. I think it will become more visible over the next few weeks.
Yeah, and actually it is on Amazon now. I was just looking at it there. It's got the new cover and release date February 12th, 2025. Could they also get it through like their local Catholic bookstore?
If you go to your bookstore and ask, they would probably be able to order it. Well, I'm a great supporter of local bookstores. I'm a member of the Catholic Marketing Network and all of that. So I appreciate these folks. And it's really, it's a tough time in the Catholic bookstore world because so much of this business has gone online and the local store operators are really kind of in a squeeze. And that's a shame because Catholic bookstores have always served a very valuable function. They're sort of little community centers within their Catholic, local Catholic circles. So by all means, support them.
Wonderful. Well, Bill, it is fascinating to talk to you about all this. We'll have to chat another time. I just really appreciate you coming on the show today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tony. I'm really grateful that you're taking interest in it and you're willing to shine a light on it. That's very helpful.
Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have for the show today. We've been speaking with Bill Castle, again, about his book, My Brother's Keeper, and some of the deeper reflections on the entire life of Christ that you can see. Again, this is Anthony Barone Kolenc. If you want to find out more about me and my books and my own speaking ministry, go to my website, anthonykolenc.com. But until next time, may God bless us as we rely on our faith to work through the messy challenges of our lives.